We led to swear.
War Room Impeachment. With Stephen K. Bannon, Jason Miller, and Raheem Kassam. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Welcome to War Room Impeachment, live from Capitol Hill. Another rainy and dreary day on the nation at the nation's capital. We're live just yards from where Donald J. Trump, the 45th president of the United States, was impeached a couple of weeks ago. Impeached, right before the Christmas break, right before the Christmas holidays, because he was, according to the Democrats, a clear and present danger to the national security of the United States. Of course, that's all in hang fire. Yeah, my mic's fine. You don't need to play with the producer. I'm good. Don't touch. We're here in episode 98 on the John Frederick Radio Network, Salem Broadcast Radio Network, America's Voice.news, and Newsmax TV, the fastest growing cable operation in a news in cable news. Here on our Saturday show, remember, here 7 days a week until the day after the acquittal or the exoneration of Donald J. Trump, the 45th president of the United States, in the United States Senate. A lot of news yesterday, kind of a stalemate. Turns out it's not a lot has happened over the holidays in the discussions and negotiations between the leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, and Chuck Schumer. They kind of went tit for tat yesterday. Raheem Kassam will be in tomorrow. Going to go through all of that. We have a very special guest today, Bill Gertz. No, Bill, the answer is, as you talked over our intro music, no, this is a family show. We're nationally broadcast. You cannot curse, okay? Bill Gertz is the national security correspondent for the Washington Times, been at the Washington Times for, 30-plus years, one of the most revered, respected national security writers in Washington and throughout the country, author of 8 books. Four of them have been national New York Times bestsellers. The China Threat, and I mean, this is over a period of 20, 25 years. The China Threat back in the early 2000s exposed a lot. Was the first person, I think, really to identify China as a rising threat. Talked about the Clinton administration. The one I love the most of all of them, of all 8, until Deceiving the Sky came out, was iWars, which really talked about information warfare in a sophisticated way. We're going to have links to all of Bill Gertz's book. Bill, thank you for joining us very much. And now you know the house rules that, you know, this is family. This is we're G-rated here.
Great to be here.
Real quickly, you've been at the Washington Times, which the Washington Times in the conservative movement has always been. Arnold de Borgiagraf was the original founding editor of it. It's always had a strong anti-communist, anti-America, really America first national security policy. It's been, I think, in the conservative movement, always known as the national security site where people went in the Reagan administration. In fact, it was founded during the Reagan administration. You've been there for a long time. Talk to us. What has your beat been over that time period? What have you followed? What are you focused on?
Arno de Borgiagraf hired me way back in the 80s and basically let me loose on national security. We had 3 defense writers. I was the 3rd defense writer as a young reporter covering the intel beat. And basically, I was able to develop some really good sources that provided me with some amazing things, some leaks that you just couldn't imagine, classified documents, inside stuff, multiple sources. And so I had a really incredible starting period in those 80s and 90s coming up. And it was just a tremendous time to be a reporter. And right now, we're moving forward in the digital age, which is a real challenge. The whole news business is facing real challenges to try to keep readers and find readers.
But you're reporting in his latest book, Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. And why we wanted to have Bill, by the way, it's a must read. We're going to get this up on the site. We'll talk more about the book in the second half of the show. The reason we wanted Bill to, and now Bill's playing sound producer. This is too high in your ears,
no,
though.
No, it's good.
It's perfect. You're okay? You're good? You got a coffee? You're fine?
Yeah.
You know, I didn't realize what a diva Gertz was, right? He kind of come here. Everything. Bill Gertz is in studio with us. Walk the audience through. Our show is focused on impeachment. What we try to do 1 hour a day is get people totally up to date. there has been such, and we have a lot of news to report and things we're going to talk about over the weekend about the trial and Nancy Pelosi coming back and slow walking. But the whole push on this was really the Washington consensus, the interagency consensus versus Trump's America First national security policy. Now in the middle of this, we have, the takedown of Soleimani, right? And who's, you know, obviously one of the most important characters on the world stage, particularly in this kind of expanded war I think we've been engaged in for quite a while, as you and I have talked about when we've been on media, when we've been on Guo Media, when we've been on other things, broadcasting into China. Walk the audience through, what do you think has transpired in the last two or three days?
Well, a major terrorist leader has been taken off the global stage, and someone on par with Osama bin Laden or al-Baghdadi, this guy was someone who has killed hundreds of Americans and maimed a large number of others. He was responsible for importing these shaped projectiles, which were used to blow up Humvees in Iraq and
the IED during the 2005-6-7 time frame.
Yeah, these were again shaped charges that were designed by the Iranians to go through armored vehicles, and so that was kind of the numbers that the Trump administration has used is somewhere around 608 Americans were killed by the Quds Force, which is basically the shock troops of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Again, the most important.
They're the special force. Hezbollah is the expeditionary force. The Quds Force are the special forces, paramilitary around that.
If you think of it, it's a combination of the CIA and the special operations forces of the U.S. military. They're both paramilitary forces as well as intelligence operatives, covert action type of forces. And very, very deadly, very serious, very well funded. They have businesses that they fund their operations with. They have sleeper cells throughout the world. And clearly, taking this guy off the stage was a major step forward. I think it reflects President Trump's overall operating strategy. He doesn't strike first, he counterattacks. And this was definitely a defensive counterattack against a terrorist leader that was planning attacks and had already carried out numerous attacks.
You talk about taking him off the stage. Let's talk about that stage for a second. You now have a arc to the. And you've reported this from the beginning. You report the Iraq War. You know, this is really the third war we're in the last 20 years. I would actually say that, you know, in 1979, I was a junior naval officer on a destroyer, supposed to be going for my second deployment in a year to the South China Sea in the Western Pacific in the 7th Fleet in a carrier battle group. And we were a plane guard ship in the ASW Vanguard. And we were sent to the North Arabian Sea and to the Persian Gulf because of the hostage crisis. I would actually say we've been engaged in this conflict with the Iranian Revolution since 1979, since they took the hostages, right? And, they're the ones that blew up the barracks in Lebanon, right? That killed still the bloodiest day of of a terrorist strike on the Marine Corps. And we've been engaged with these guys since that time. But Soleimani brought something different. This arc, this Shiite arc to the sea that they talk about that goes through Baghdad, Damascus, and Beirut, in his combination of CIA, national security guy, State Department, he combines all of those. He puts the alliances together. He's the strategist and the operative.
Yes, and again, very effective. He built up organizations that were essentially proxy forces for Iran to conduct operations, whether they were intel operations, whether they were paramilitary insurgencies. Clearly, Hezbollah is a major terrorist organization. Palestinian Islamic Jihad has been, getting support from them. The Houthis in Yemen also. And of course, bolstering the Assad regime was a main staple for Soleimani. And that was basically a key in order for the Iranians to continue supplying Hezbollah in Lebanon.
So why in this last 72 hours, as you've read the, and people have talked to you about the intelligence, and as you're reporting this, why, you know, the Democrats said that President Trump has to be impeached because he's a clear and present danger to national security, given the testimony that was shown by the interagency process, by the people who had a different idea about how the Ukraine should be handled. So he's a clear and present danger. We had to impeach him before Christmas because it was so urgent. Of course, here, 2 weeks later, 2.5 weeks later, we're in hang fire. Why was it in the Trump administration that's really this has an America first mindset, and you just said President Trump is a great counterpuncher, counterstrike. Why now? Why did we have to go and target him with a drone now?
Well, the administration briefed reporters on this yesterday, and they were adamant that there was a imminent threat of major operations to U.S. diplomats and military personnel. No details have been released on what was actually being planned, but clearly they had the opportunity to take him out. Bold strike at the Iraqi airport with a drone strike, and not only took out Soleimani, but also a major pro-Iranian militia.
Is it pretty bold for him to be flying just into the private air terminal in the middle of the night in Baghdad and be picked up by a couple of drivers, have his own caravan, like a VIP?
I think that he travels with heavy security. That would be the tip-off. This was a great intelligence success for the United States to be able to identify that it was, in fact, him, that he was another militia leader with him, and then to be able to move quickly.
The militia leader, the Iraqi militia leader in Iraq is as big a deal as he is, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, and it says something about the situation in Iraq that this guy could operate freely in that country. And so clearly, a lot of Iraqis took to the street to cheer the death of Soleimani. They recognize.
Well, the Sunni side of it.
Yeah.
But the Sunni side, I mean, these guys actually, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't the Shiite militias central to the destruction of the physical caliphate of ISIS? Weren't they let loose on the physical caliphate of ISIS? He's known, and at least they're bragging that he was the biggest ISIS. The Soleimani did more to take down ISIS than any one guy. Now, President Trump in the last, 6 months has got al-Baghdadi and Soleimani. So he's taken down the head of really ISIS and the head of the Iranian Expeditionary Force.
Well, you know, this whole idea of decapitation, I'm not sure is the best idea. I mean, the whole strategy against al-Qaeda.
What do you mean, not best idea? Everybody's beaten on their chest now that we took this.
Yeah, I'll explain. Okay. Basically, we killed off all the al-Qaeda leaders, and what happened? We created a new organization called ISIS, which, again, was even more radical than al-Qaeda. And where did it start? It started in Iraq. They attacked a bunch of prisons and released some of the most hardened terrorists. And so that kind of created it. So I'm not a fan of the decapitation strategy that's been used. That is taking out terrorist leaders because they regenerate.
And think the same thing here with Soleimani?
They've already announced the replacement to him. The U.S. officials' response to that is nobody will be able to replace him because he was a unique.
If you don't agree with the decapitation or take the head off the snake, what strategy do you use against these guys?
Well, information warfare. America has great military power, intelligence power, diplomatic power, but very weak information power. And we're getting killed in the information
space. What do you mean by that? Define that for people.
We have no centralized ability to use information as a weapon against our enemies. If you look at VOA today, what are they reporting? It's fluff. They report entertainment news. There's an urgent need, and this was the thesis of my book, I War, urgent need to reform our information capabilities. The U.S. government shouldn't be funding things like NPR and VOA as government-funded news outlets. We really need counter-disinformation and aggressive, assertive, offensive information operations.
So you're saying that the government should be in these international spheres into the propaganda business?
Well, yes, absolutely. There's no question. I mean, propaganda has a bad taste for a lot of people, but you know, the founding fathers used propaganda in the Revolutionary War.
What is so strong about our enemies in this regard? Let's just stick with Iran. I want to get to China later. But what is so strong about does Iran have a robust information war platform?
Yes. And you'll see this in their cyber attacks. You'll see that in their ability to maintain narratives about what's happening inside their country, describing the mass protests that recently were
wasn't
there.
One of the key elements of the JCPOA, of the deal that was struck with Iran, that we would shut down the Farsi language VOA aspect of VOA.
I'm not certain about
that. Yeah, I remember the Farsi people told.
I think certainly very weak.
Well, the Farsi language, I think, was really downsized, or that. Let's go to, how do you think, everybody's running around now, and I've got all the headlines here from all the papers. Tehran pledges revenge as U.S. kills military chief Soleimani. Threats deployment after U.S. strike. You know, we just deployed that's the Washington Post, the lead story. We deployed the 82nd Airborne, a brigade off the 82nd Airborne. Trump warns Iran as Ayatollah vows revenge, banner headline in the paper of record, the failing New York Times, as the president would call it, and the Wall Street Journal, Mideast tensions rise after strike. So everybody's on pins and needles about this. Is this ratcheting up this war? Is this engaging in a tit for tat? Is this going to increase an escalation cycle?
I think it's reflective of the Trump policy of peace through strength. This has sent a message to Tehran that's unequivocal. And it's the first time in several administrations, both Republican and Democratic, that if you kill Americans, expect to die. And so what could happen? They could cut off oil. That's less of a concern for us. It's much more of a concern for nations like China and Europe. We've become much more energy independent. Will they go to war with the U.S.? That would be a certain.
But this is the thesis. Are they at war with us already? You're saying go to war. Are they at war with us?
I mean, in a declared conventional, non-asymmetric warfare, that's what
believe they're at asymmetric war with us now have been for many decades.
Yes.
What's your definition? Give the audience, tell the audience, what is asymmetric? Sounds like a fancy Harvard Business School term or one of these jargon things out of the Pentagon. What's asymmetric warfare? Why is it important? How do they execute it on us?
Well, asymmetric warfare is how a weaker power uses its forces and capabilities to defeat a stronger power. The Chinese pioneered this. The Iranians have adopted it. They're using information warfare, covert action, intelligence warfare, paramilitary warfare, and of course, most notably, terrorism. They are the world's leading sponsor of terrorism.
State-sponsored terrorism.
Yes.
And you think that although you don't agree with biting the head off the snake as a total solution, you do agree that this will definitely degrade their capabilities, since he is considered the strategist and the guy that executes.
He has been credited with doing more creative types of operations.
You say credited in a way that you don't agree with that? You say he's been credited.
I don't know his capabilities. But according to U.S. officials, he is the guy that is doing the most to advance Iranian interests through covert action, paramilitary, and terrorist attacks.
You mentioned information warfare in your book, and we're going to get to this in the second part of the show, but the seminal work that kind of broke this was about the Gulf, really the original kind of Gulf War back in the 90s. It was written by two Chinese colonels in the PLA at the time, in the late 90s, published 99, right when they were coming into the World Trade Organization, most favored nation on a global scale, and that is unrestricted warfare. And we've had two responses to unrestricted warfare laid out in modern terms, or in terms that warfare had changed, kind of its functionality, that you had three aspects of it: information warfare, economic warfare, and kinetic warfare. And kinetic is the way that the West thinks about war, which is conventional armies, you know, people stand up in with carrier battle groups or paratroopers, or however you want to do it. Air, Space, Land 2000, the deep interdiction in the against the Soviets, the tactical nuclear weapons, all that. But that they posited the future was going to be on information warfare and economic warfare. And that is how powers like China could rise and actually overwhelm the West. You focused in IWAR on the information war. And the information war had two parts. Number one was the propaganda and the content part of it. The second was cyber, using cyber. Walk through, and then you had a response. Deceiving the sky is a response to unrestricted warfare. Definitely you have an entire chapter in here in this book, but you actually walk through it. Michael Pillsbury, who is now known as one of the president's advisors, a guy that we brought in to help set up the China team early on in the administration. His book, 100-Year Marathon, I think is also a Western version of explaining unrestricted warfare. Why is this book important, and why does it play into what's happening in Iran and how people can make sense of what's going on right now?
Well, if you don't understand how the enemy is operating, you're never going to be successful in mitigating the threat. And, you know, as the strategist Angelo Codevilla said, basically, the only way to bring about peace is to wage all types of warfare against your enemy till they stop fighting. And until they stop fighting, you're never going to have peace, and it requires reaching victory. In unrestricted warfare, these two colonels have decided that they can't go head on. And this goes back to the like 200 or 300 BC at a period of the Warring States era in China, where there were feudal warlords fighting among each other, and they had to figure out unique ways to wage war against stronger powers. The Iranians have adopted that. We see that most notably in the Quds Force, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps Quds Force, which was headed by Soleimani. And they understand, they use proxy forces, they fund them, they arm them. This is why they provided these shaped charges in Iraq, which were used to kill so many Americans, because they understood that if they caused U.S. casualties, they could weaken the will of the United States to
and use the media to do that. Use those news stories and the commentary to do that. Okay, we've got to take a break here. It's episode 98, War Room Impeachment. Bill Gertz, national security correspondent for the Washington Times, is our guest. You can go to warroom.org. We're going to have a lot of breakouts of the story today. It's now America kind of engages in this ongoing war with the radical regime in Iran. In the middle or the beginning of the trial of the president, this trial that's going to take place starting, we hope, in the next couple of weeks. This is Stephen K. Bannon, War Room Impeachment, episode 98. We're going to return with Bill Gertz in Deceiving the Sky in a moment.
War Room Impeachment. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Welcome back to War Room Impeachment, live from Capitol Hill. It's Saturday, the 4th of January, the year of our Lord, 2020. We're on episode 98, live on the John Frederick Radio Network, the Salem Broadcast Radio Network nationwide, americasvoice.news, a global platform of live streaming and Newsmax TV. Honored to have, from the Washington Times, the national security correspondent, Bill Gertz. Define your... what do you think the Trump doctrine is, and what does America First mean to you from a national security perspective?
The Trump doctrine, again, if you want to understand Trump, he's a counterpuncher. So he doesn't like to strike first. Obviously, preemption is never ruled out in the course of strategy and tactics. But America First, to me, is a throwback to the Reagan era of peace through strength. And again, that phrase has come up in Trump's policies. But again, he believes very strongly that America is off track, that the push towards globalization has meant that the whole concept of national sovereignty has been denigrated. And he wants to restore patriotism. He wants to restore love of country. And I think that's really at the heart of America First.
What did you think in the impeachment trial? You had the national security apparatus, what I call the Morning Joe, David Ignatius, Richard Haass crowd, really showed the big gulf between the way President Trump rolls and the interagency consensus. How did you look at that as a national security correspondent?
Yeah, I recently did a piece for the Washington Times that looked at the efforts underway now, finally, to streamline the National Security Council staff. I'm not sure it's a smart idea to just make the National Security staff a sole coordinating body. I think they need to have policy input as well. They shouldn't be devoid of policy, but clearly...
You're saying you don't agree with the Scowcroft model where it just essentially curates all the different agencies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I agree with the Reagan model. I talk about that in Deceiving the Sky. Roger Robinson went in the Oval Office with Reagan and Bill Clark said, look, I think we can take down the Soviet Union through financial warfare. And Reagan said, go do it. And they were very, very successful in doing that. Trump, I think, is doing the similar kind of thing with China today. He's recognizing that if you cut off the massive theft of technology that China has been undertaking, will China be able to survive the so-called China miracle?
Well, let's talk about it. The book is Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy, and is inextricably linked into the Iran situation. We're at economic. You have four or five powers led by China trying to control the Eurasian landmass. So you have China's the head of the snake. You have its vassal state, North Korea, which is in the nuclear weapons business to keep Japan and America on its back foot. You've got Iran's their partner. You have, I believe, Turkey and Erdogan is their new junior partner. And then Russia is now throwing in. So you have these four or five powers led by China, the One Belt, One Road. They're trying to reorganize the global economy around China as the manufacturing base, doing a logistics chain, a One Belt, One Road. Iran is inextricably linked to that. We have had economic warfare. You know, we've got brutal sanctions on Iran, maybe not enough. We've got sanctions on Russia. President Trump has threatened additional sanctions on Turkey. He said, I can basically destroy your economy if you get a line, NATO ally. We have, I think, sanctions on China, which is the trade war, and part of that may be coming off. And we've got, debilitating sanctions on North Korea. The sanctions in Iran, as poorly as they are executed, are working. Is there any doubt in your mind they're working?
No doubt they're working.
Okay, here's one of the reasons they're working. In the streets of Beirut, in the streets of Baghdad, in the streets of Tehran, millennials are in an open revolt, a revolt against Hezbollah in Beirut. We've had the young woman who's one of the leaders on here a couple weeks ago. We've in Baghdad, you've had these riots that have been going on about the millennials, and in Tehran itself. Itself is at the, so the economic war. In fact, Soleimani, I believe the report's saying the reason he's hop, skipping, and jumping around the Middle East on his private jet is because he's going to see how that could be put down. Because the economic war, the sanctions on Iran, the economic warfare is working. You believe in that?
With the exception that the Europeans don't seem to be imposing the same type of...
Now we talk about our allies. These are our great NATO allies, led by Macron, who at Biarritz brings the foreign minister of Iran up there. What they're trying to talk about, this is France is putting its economic interest first. And as far as being an ally, Europe's been very tough. But more importantly, China. China is not sanctions. China is not living up to the sanctions, correct? They're the principal buyer of oil from Iran?
Well, under the Iran nuclear deal, Iran will very soon, within a few months this year, be permitted to buy conventional arms from both Russia and China. And we know that both countries have been major suppliers for the Iranian regime, including missiles, drones, all kinds of...
In fact, they're talking about if there's a drone, if there's a drone strike or a drone pushback, it'll come from Chinese technology. And as a matter of fact, we're not absolutely sure even today what hit the Arab, the Saudi Arabian facility, but it might have been a Chinese drone patrolled by the Quds Force, right?
Yes. The Chinese have been supplying a lot of electronic warfare equipment to the Iranians. The North Koreans have been sharing missile technology. Now, the North Koreans now have a long-range missile, and there's really no weapon system that the North Koreans have that they haven't shared internationally.
So if you have the economic sanctions are working and we haven't even gotten our European allies to buy in 100% or to do it, you got France and Macron, I think, trying to backdoor us on this all the time. And China is blatantly not. China buys, I think they take most of the oil. They pay RMB for it, right? So they still got to convert it into cash. They've also made massive loans. You know, Xi went to Iran, I think in September of 2016, to talk about the strategic partnership that they're going to have. And they consider them their strategic partnership. In fact, it's open in the Chinese Communist Party. They consider Iran their partner in South, you know, what they call Southeast Asia or Southwest Asia, however you look at the map. But that's their anchor. That's their partner there for their expansion of One Belt, One Road, and also now their maritime strategy. Last week, I mean, I know it wasn't a big exercise, qua exercise, but the symbolism of China, Iran, and Russia doing a naval exercise in the North Arabian Sea, in the Persian Gulf, how big a deal is that?
Oh, it's huge. Strategically, the Chinese talk about their, quote, peaceful rise. But what is not mentioned is that part of that rise depends on the demise of the United States. So their secondary strategy.
Part of it or central to it?
It's part of it.
What's the other part? Because if we don't see the demise of the United States, there's no rise.
Yeah. Well, they understand that their success to become the dominant superpower in the world is the demise
is
of the United
States. Is that their focus?
Yes.
Is their focus to become
Absolutely.
The dominant superpower?
Absolutely.
There's no doubt in your mind.
Yes.
How do you back that up? Give me some data here, because you're going to have guys, I know people's heads are blowing up right now. By the way, for people that want the book, it's going to come out in audio. Encounter, Roger Kimball, the great guys at Encounter Press, one of the classiest presses out there. I'm very impressed, Gertz.
Yeah.
Deceiving the Sky. It's coming out in audio at some time in the future?
Yes, very soon.
Very soon. Yeah, audio. Yeah. Okay, let's go back. In the book, how do you back up the fact that China, well, I thought it's all win-win.
Well,
I thought it's all win-win. You know, Hank Paulson and Henry Kissinger keep telling it's a strategic economic dialogue, they're strategic partners, it's all win-win. You're saying something different.
Total deception. And again, to understand China, you have to understand their use of deception. Win-win means everything wins for China. All you need to do is look at Xi Jinping's elicitation of the China dream. This is their strategy to make China the dominant global power. They believe
make China great again after the 150 or 200 years of humiliation by
exactly.
the West.
Yeah. And they have almost a racist, the Communist Party of China has almost a racist approach to this, that the Chinese nation must become the dominant global power. And they're working very diligently to do that. Again, there's an encirclement strategy. The Belt and Road Initiative is, again, a Trojan horse of expansionism, economically.
What is for our audience, what's the Belt and Road Initiative?
It's a major multi-trillion-dollar investment project, and the way it works is they'll go into a poor country
that really takes from China and as a logistics train of ports, highways, infrastructure that goes from China all the way into Europe, right through
right.
Central Asia and
right.
through Iran, through connects
South
all these
America,
countries. Well, South
Africa,
Sub-Saharan Africa and South America come right. next, but the key thing is the Eurasian landmass,
yes.
right to Europe.
Yeah. And so they'll go into a country and they'll say, we'll help you build a railroad. In fact, we'll even help finance it for you. And so they'll finance it at exorbitant rates. And when the country says, well, we can't pay you the loan back, well, then they'll say, well, that railroad's ours or
right,
that port facility's
right now,
ours.
Right now, in this One Belt, One Road or their hegemonic expansion on the Eurasian landmass with Iran as I think Iran is their central partner, more important than Russia, more important than Turkey, more important than the vassal state Korea, which they're all important, but Iran being the central key that picks the lock for them, they are the financier. They've got big credit lines to them. They buy their oil. This is the way the... Why are we not, instead of taking out Soleimani, which, by the way, is a bad guy, and I hope he deserves his time in hell, right, for what he's done to American troops, but it's one thing of putting IEDs out and going after individual American fighting forces, as bad and evil as that is, and it should be shut down, has to be shut down, versus the real kill shot, which is they're working with the power that is in our face that they want to be and will be the existential power. They're an existential threat because they will be the dominant power of the 21st century. They will write the history of the 21st century. Knowing that their central link is Iran, why are we not all over that link?
Well, there's still a debate within the Trump administration on how to deal with China. And part of the problem is, for the last 40 years, we've integrated our economy with China. So we're stuck now. We're looking at ways to decouple. I recently interviewed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. I said, one of the debates in foreign policy now is the notion of decoupling our economy from China. And he thought about it for a minute and said, our policy is not to decouple. However, China could decouple itself from the U.S. economy if it continues with its illicit trading behavior and other activities. So, again, there's a debate within the Trump administration. Trump has made incredible progress in shifting the focus of American foreign policy towards China, and it's just incredible. But it's not a done deal. There are forces in there that want to continue, go back to the engagement policy of the 1990s, which reached its zenith under Bill Clinton, where we ended up doing nuclear cooperation and space cooperation, and what happened?
Much of the military technology they have today was given to them by the Clinton administration or people that were supporting and financing, you know, Loral. These companies were...
Every deployed warhead in the U.S. arsenal was compromised to China through espionage during the 90s as a result of nuclear cooperation and space cooperation.
Did Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats, did they find that a clear and present danger? Did the Democrats look at the history of their administrations? Repeat that what you just said about what happened with China in the 90s.
Yeah, the Clinton administration had a policy of unfettered engagement. They pushed and got them in the World Trade Organization, even though they weren't a market economy. And as a result of espionage...
But this was also pushed by Republicans. It wasn't just Clinton. It was the Clinton administration,
yes,
but the pom-poms were out. This was totally bipartisan, right? Not maybe the national security technology aspect of it, but China as part of the most favored nations, World Trade Organization, and it's going to become a liberal democracy over time.
It was a 30, 40-year gamble that was an utter disaster. This notion, if we just trade with China, if we're
was
just
it a gamble,
nice to them,
or is it, we talk about our intelligence apparatus. This is the other thing about this intelligence apparatus has been wrong on everything. Wrong and lied to people's faces about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Part of it was wrong. Part of it was just lie with a straight face. They completely missed the rise of China, and I say miss in quotes because I'm not so sure certain elements of it were not compromised and did miss it. And now we depend upon their intelligence to take out Soleimani. Why? And you look at the intelligence, the whole thing and the impeachment of President Trump is that it's the nullification project is driven by part of the apparatus that is engaged. It's the whistleblower. It's Brennan. It's the entire apparatus. Why are we depending upon them to get us information on Soleimani that we believe?
Yeah, it's amazing. It seems like the CIA can do a good job when it's not focused on domestic politics.
Did the CIA miss? Is this a act of omission or act of commission? How did they miss the rise of China? How did up until President Trump in the summer and fall of 2016, when he's identifying China as the great existential threat, and that they've taken all our jobs and we financed them and gave them the technology, or they've stolen it, and Obama goes into the Rose Garden with Xi and signs this thing to no more cyber intrusions, no militarization of South China Sea. Xi signed it, looked at the American people, lied in their face, more cyber intrusions, total militarizations of the South China Sea in Hong Kong. They lied to our face, to both the Thatcher, to Reagan, to everybody, to the Bushes, lied to their face about what their intentions were in Hong Kong. In the Paris Accord, we now know the Financial Times breaks the story that, hey, they're building, $500 billion worth of coal-fired plants to get their economy going again, to become, get as cheap energy as possible since they don't have any natural resources and oil. They lied to people's face, had no intention of doing anything Paris Accord. They look in, and this is not about the Chinese people. Chinese people are the most noble, decent, hardworking people on earth. You can see that in Hong Kong, where combination with English common law, they've built the third greatest capital market in the world. But the Chinese Communist Party is a collection of gangsters. They're in business with gangsters like in Tehran. The mullahs are just a gangster operation. Soleimani is a mob boss. This is why they're gangsters. They deal with Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a group of gangsters. Why are millennials on the streets in Beirut? Why are millennials on the streets in Baghdad? Why are millennials on the streets in Tehran? The same reason, ladies and gentlemen, that they're on the streets in Hong Kong. Because they're tired of the gangsters. Lebanon's now in total bankruptcy, right? $80 billion. The woman sat here. They don't even know where the money went, right? The money is stolen by gangster mentality, gangster operations. Why don't we treat these people like the gangsters they are? Why do we treat them as legitimate governments?
Well, I want to go back to what you mentioned earlier, and that's why did the U.S. get it wrong? And I spent a lot of time in Deceiving the Sky and my other books explaining it. And it's not just the policy community. It's the intelligence community. For decades, there has been a groupthink that that there is no threat from China. And I recount this in the book. In the late 90s, I went to the Defense Intelligence Agency for a briefing on the PLA, the People's Liberation Army. And it was a fairly vanilla briefing. And at the end of the briefing, a colonel came in and said, the general would like to see you. And the general was the director of the DIA. I'm not going to say who it was because it was background. But he told me, he sat in the conference room, sat at the end of a table and told me, China's not a threat. And I said to him, why do you think that? And he essentially said, because they say they're not a threat. And I was astounded. I said, I could imagine
Barbarian that. Management 101.
But this, and the reason why he was saying that, it turned out a little bit later, was that one of the chief intelligence analysts in the DIA was a Chinese spy. It was a guy named Ron Monteperto. And he was the leading advocate for doing business with Chinese intelligence as they were a normal nation. So the groupthink within the intelligence community for many, many years was the notion that we can't treat China as a nuclear-armed communist dictatorship that it is, and that we have to treat them as a normal nation. And it was an utter disaster.
As we go back, the book is Deceiving the Sky. Bill Gertz, we're going to have it up. He's got a string of great books. He's got Information War. And if you want to go back and see the beginning, read the China Threat. I think it came out in 2000. It's amazing. Yeah. Go read Bill Gertz's China Threat in 2000. And you got to ask, why was everybody asleep? Why America slept? We only got a couple of minutes left. We're about to start the trial of the century in the next couple of weeks, as we call it here, the impeachment, the trial in the Senate to impeach Donald, impeaching Donald J. Trump. President Trump, because he's a master communication strategist, turned it around and said it's actually the crime of the century. And the crime of the century is really the national security apparatus and the intelligence community and the FBI coming after President Trump on this nullification project. We now have, it looks like, I don't want to say the beginnings of war, but really engagement in a more public way of this war that's been going on between the mullahs and the United States for 40 or 50 years. How do you think this is going to play out, given that we have a trial for impeachment, the Chinese are watching, our enemies are watching, now we're engaged, and I'm sure over the next couple of days it's going to be some tit for tat. We got the 82nd Airborne now forward deployed, a brigade of those guys forward deployed to Kuwait. How do you think this plays out in the middle of this trial?
Well, I think from an information warfare standpoint, the United States should be prepared for some type of Iranian action designed to influence the political entities in the United States.
Wow. What do you mean by that?
Well, they could orient an operation, a terrorist attack or something, designed to influence the outcome of the impeachment trial in the Senate.
Be specific. You're saying they want to influence the impeachment trial, and clearly they don't want President Trump as president after November 3rd, 2020.
Well, yeah. I mean, the real abuse of power has been on the part of the Democrats in launching the entire impeachment debacle. But I think that we should be on alert for, again, we've got an election coming up. We know that there's going to be foreign interference in the election or attempts. And I think the Iranians may try to do something in retaliation from an information sphere that could combine elements of a terrorist attack, some type of covert operations, influence operations, social media. I think we ought to be on the alert. I think people should be very, very wary of that.
We only got a minute left. Have you seen anything on the Democrat stage in these debates? I know you follow them closely. On the national security side, they almost get asked no questions. But when they do, can you really define what the national security, given the fact that I keep saying, hey, this is like 1936, this is storm clouds on the horizon. We make smart decisions, no war, make dumb decisions, could be a broader kinetic conflict. Have you seen anything on the Democrat side that leads you to believe that anybody has a point of view of how the world works?
You know, in the political war that is Washington these days, I think there's one slight bright light, and that's China. I think that there's a recognition, even on the part of the Democrats, that the threat from China is overwhelming.
Well, in the House, Nancy Pelosi, you're talking about the 417-1 vote for Hong Kong and the Senate vote, but do you see that in the in the people running for president? We got 30 seconds.
I think there's China is going to be a major focus of the political campaign for 2020.
Bill Gertz is author of Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. It's a must read. You can go to his website. You can go to our website. We're going to get all the information. How do people, real quickly, what's your Twitter handle? How do people follow you?
At Bill Gertz is my Twitter handle. My website is gertzfile.com. You can see all my stories and books there.
Bill Gertz, a national security correspondent for The Washington Times. Okay, go to warroom.org. Gertz's will be up. This is episode 98. All of the information will be up shortly about this episode. Join tomorrow morning live, 9 a.m. Raheem Kassam will be here. I will be on assignment. We're going to be back Monday live, 9 a.m. again. 100th episode, episode 98. Goodbye.
Clear?
That's a wrap.
All right. You